We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This podcast episode is brought to you by Coors Light. These days, everything is go, go, go. It's nonstop hustle all the time. Work, friends, family expect you to be on 24/7. Well, sometimes you just need to reach for a Coors Light because it's made to chill. Coors Light is cold lagered, cold filtered, and cold packaged. It's as crisp and refreshing as the Colorado Rockies. It is literally made to chill. Coors Light is the one I choose when I need to unwind. So when you want to hit reset, reach for the beer that's made to chill. Get Coors Light in the new look delivered straight to your door with Drizzly or Instacart. Celebrate responsibly. Coors Brewing Company, Golden, Colorado.
And welcome to In the Know, the Hornets 24/7 podcast. Your knowledgeable hosts are Michael McNamara.
Me and a grizzly bear, I'm betting on me.
And me, Ryan Schwan.
I've been playing some Dungeons & Dragons because I'm really cool like that.
Let's get it started. All Hornets, all the time.
Welcome to the show. Michael and I are recapping this after a loss on a Sunday afternoon. But before we talk about the Knicks, the Hornets did beat Minnesota, pulling off a 1-1 since our last podcast, which is exactly what we predicted because we're always right with our predictions. Right, Michael?
Yeah, I mean, that's all I ever hear after these podcasts about is about how I'm dead on with everything. But no, I mean, I think this little two-game stretch was pretty easy to call. I mean, I was actually shocked when Minnesota jumped out ahead in that first quarter because that's, you know, such a offensively limited team without Kevin Love. I think we saw that one coming. And the Knicks matchup, like I said, is just not a good matchup for the Hornets. So 1-1, saw it coming.
Yeah. I thought for a while there, Derek Williams in that Minnesota game was going to have his coming out party against us.
Yeah, it was strictly against Xavier Henry, who, I mean, you just knew Monty was desperate in that first quarter to try anything because nobody really had sign of life there. He puts in Xavier Henry for a couple minutes, and Derek Williams just proceeds to get two rather easy layups against Henry, but had trouble the rest of the day.
Yeah, I mean, am I right in saying he played every player in that first quarter? I think he did.
I mean, even Donald Sloan got a look, and I mean, this is a guy in Donald Sloan who the only other time we saw him this season, he was in for 17 seconds and imagined to fall flat on his back with nobody touching him just by tripping over himself and backpedal. So that's how desperate Monty was to just experiment with anything in this first quarter where the Hornets just seemed lifeless.
Yeah. I mean, it was bad enough that I was thinking that I needed to stop, wait for the game to be over, then find out the score so I wouldn't be, like, screaming at it. I'd just be okay. But instead, I didn't, and I watched the whole game, and I'm very glad I did.
Yeah, that first quarter could have been even worse. It was 29-14, Rhino hit a big three, Vasquez, you know, got a couple of those buckets that we talked about last week where it's like, it's at the beginning of the game, so nobody's really paying attention, and they're not clutch buckets, so you don't give them credit for it, but those couple of points in a quarter when the Hornets were really struggling kept them within striking distance for when they finally got their footing.
And again, it looked like it was going to be, you know, just like the previous game against them, where Pekovic was just going to muscle us all around, just destroy us. I mean, he's getting little tip-ins. He was muscling everybody around who was guarding him. There was one play where he just kind of shrugged off Anthony Davis with a shoulder, and Davis went flying. I mean, that's how much stronger Pekovic is to Davis. So it was pretty bad that first quarter. And then everything magically turned around.
Yeah, but in the middle of the second quarter, I mean, Vasquez picks up his third foul, and I don't want this to get into Vasquez got up the court. That's why we suddenly got good. But Vasquez goes off with his third foul, and Monty had a couple of options. He could have had Roberts or Rivers come in and try to hold down the point for those couple of minutes, but he just put the ball in Eric Gordon's hands. Eric Gordon ran the offense the rest of the half, and the Hornets finished that half on an 18-7 run.
Yeah, and I won't even say it was a particularly awesome offense. That he was generating, he wasn't like breaking down and dishing, but he did a fine job as the point guard, and he was aggressive at times. So, I mean, the weirdest thing about this game though is just the discrepancy in free throws. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen a game where the team won, where they had 9 free throws compared to the other team's 33.
And it wasn't just free throws. I mean, it was fouls overall. There was one point in this game before the refs made some makeup calls when the game was already decided. There's one point at this game where the Hornets had committed 20 fouls and Minnesota had only committed 4. Yeah. I mean that's impossible unless they're either the most agile defenders in the world or they're just incredibly soft, which they're not. I don't see how the refs could only blow the whistle 4 times in the first, 2.5 quarters.
And I will also say, to mention more about Vasquez. He had a lot of foul trouble in the first half. He's limited to 26 minutes in this game, but he was on fire for a little while in the third and fourth, and he was extremely – I mean, he ended up with 13 assists in that limited amount of time, and he was having a very nice game out there. It seemed like every time he turned around and saw Ridnour on him, his eyes like lit up. He's like, okay, I can just smoke this dude.
Yeah, I mean, in that third quarter, he had 7 points and 7 assists. He got other people going. Fourth quarter, he got a lot of those assists to Jason Smith, who was just red hot.
Right.
I mean, the overall theme that I am 100% sold on after this game and the New York game, which we'll get to, is that, to me, Monty's got to find a way to have Gordon or Vasquez on court for all 48 minutes. Because there's nobody else who could initiate this offense. So even if that means that Gordon and Vasquez play together less, I think the Hornets could get away with that, as we've seen in this game. But it seems like those are the only two guys on this team that could initiate and run an offense at, an above average level. And I'm all for, 24 minutes of those guys on the court together and then 12 each off the court to ensure that, that for all 48 minutes, one of those guys is on the court because, I mean, the offense just runs so much smoother when one of those guys are at the head.
Yep. So, Robin Lopez, 27 minutes, 6 rebounds, couple assists, couple blocks, 4 points. I thought he did actually a fairly decent job on Pekovic while he was out there. Do you agree or disagree?
Yeah, I agree. I think it was a little trouble early. I mean, Pekovic started out pretty hot, but we saw a lot of what we had seen before with Ryan Anderson doing, where eventually about at the end of the first quarter of this game and on, Lopez really stopped trying to box out and rebound as much as he just focused on pushing Pekovic out of the paint and allowing other people, specifically Aminu, to come in and grab the rebounds. And I thought that was a huge change in this game because Minnesota, without Love, is just not an efficient team offensively, and if you hold them to just 6 offensive rebounds, they're not going to be able to get a quantity of shots, and they definitely don't have the quality. So I thought that was a huge turning point.
Right. I mean, and you just mentioned it. They had 6 offensive rebounds. They had 38 missed shots. So, I mean, if you do the math, it's probably like, what, like 13% offensive rebound rate? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the third best offensive rebounding team in the league. And, yeah, they have Kevin Love on it, but Kevin Love's been missing for 16 of those games, and they're still ranked the third best in the league. So they're a very good offensive rebounding team, even when he's not there. Dante Cunningham's pretty good. Kirilenko usually helps. Shedd usually helps. I mean, they've got a lot of guys out there who can offensive rebound, and they managed 6 all game. So that right there was a complete kudos to the Hornets for just boxing out and grabbing every defensive rebound.
Yeah, I feel like if Minnesota gets offensive rebounds, or if they get, I mean, because they're getting to the line so much in this game that if they're getting more opportunities, this is a game that would have been much closer. I mean, 33 free throw attempts to 9 is just absolutely ridiculous. And you just imagine if they got a couple more possessions, the refs would have probably blow their whistles a couple more times. So I thought that was huge. And I thought, you know, Aminu in this game did exactly what the Hornets needed him to do, with Lopez busy with a guy in Pekovic, pulling down 13 boards, 10 of them defensive, and again, very active in the passing lanes. I think that was another part where this game switched, is it seemed like Minnesota only had one or two turnovers in the first quarter. Then all of a sudden, a combination of them just making boneheaded plays, but us really being more active, Hornets started turning them over, and that was a big key to that second through fourth quarter run as well.
Yep. And, I mean, Al-Farouq Aminu's stat line is exactly what you'd want from a small forward who's not a star scorer, or, I mean, he's just a complimentary player. 5 of 7 from the field, 2 of 2 from the free throw line, 3 offensive, 10 defensive rebounds, 3 assists, 3 steals, 1 block, a couple turnovers, a couple fouls, 12 points total. I mean, if you got that, I mean, even less rebounds than that, if you got 8 rebounds a game in that stat line, wouldn't you be happy with what he gives you?
Yeah, and I mean, if you haven't watched the game yet and you put it on right now, the first 5 minutes of that game was horrible for Aminu. He got both of his turnovers in that stretch. He allowed Kirilenko to go baseline multiple times, 2 yeah. for scores, and then fouled him. So basically, Kirilenko got 6 easy points off of Aminu kind of losing focus early in that game. Aminu just looked awful in those first couple minutes. Monty called a timeout, must have said something to him, and for the rest of that game, he was one of the best players on the court for the Hornets.
Yeah, I mean, he yanked him at that point. It wasn't just that he called a timeout and then put him back on the floor. He was on the bench after that, and that was after Andrei Kirilenko had run baseline, like you said, caught the ball on the opposite side, and Aminu had just no idea he was even there. He kind of turned around, and you could see him hang his head when Kirilenko put that layup in. He knew he'd just blown that one badly. So, but, I mean, he had already done it twice before. At that point, you're kind of just like, you know, get your head in the game a little bit, Aminu, and he did. So you mentioned him briefly. When he is on fire, he makes our bench nearly unstoppable. I'm not talking Ryan Anderson, I'm talking Jason Smith.
Yeah, I mean the fourth quarter, so I felt like this was a game of quarters, and this is where it's so nice to have multiple guys who could really, you know, step up instead of just having one person carrying all the weight. I feel like Anderson in a way kept us in it in the first. I feel like Gordon helped initiate that huge run in the second. Vasquez came on in the third. And then in the fourth quarter, Jason Smith, all he does is go 6 for 6 on his mid-range shots, 12 points in that stretch, a couple of rebounds, some great weak side defense. And he, you know, essentially kills any hopes of Minnesota coming back in this game. I mean, Minnesota scores 31 points in that fourth quarter. You know, there's a comeback in them if the Hornets aren't scoring as well. But Jason Smith with 6 huge jumpers in that quarter, and I would say one of the best games that we've seen from him, since his return a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, I mean, every shot he put up was pure. It just hit the back of the rim straight down. I mean, it was great. And, they were looking for him. It was one of those things where you're kind of like wondering, what is the other team thinking?
Right.
I mean, after this is, you know, this is like his primary skill. Yeah, he can drive. Yeah, he can, you know, score a little bit off the dribble, but his primary skill is hitting that mid-range jumper off of a pick and roll. How do they leave him open again and again and again and again? I mean, I'm watching it, and they kept hedging and doubling over onto Vasquez or to Gordon. And at some point, you're just like, those guys are not shooting efficiently at the moment overall for this game. Maybe you should try sticking to Jason Smith a little bit.
Yeah.
Of course, he is also 7 feet tall, so it's kind of hard to block his shot anyways. But
I'm glad they didn't. but yeah, that was, again, a guy that kind of took it home in that quarter. I'm curious, from this game, there was one player on Minnesota's side that I really enjoyed watching. Like, it was a difference between an eye test and his stat sheet. And even his stats from the year aren't that great, but every time I watch Minnesota, he just pops to me. I'm wondering, what do you think of Alexei Shved?
I love it. I think he is extremely savvy. He plays like he's a guard who's been in the leagues for, you know, 5-6 years. And I mean, technically, he's played basketball at a high level for 4 years now, because he was in the Russian league, and he took them to, I think, the last two championships. He was their point guard. He plays really smart. He never does too much. His shooting, and even in the Russian league, he wasn't the best shooter in the world, but he's still a smart player, and he can do a lot for you. And he's also, I think he's only 23.
24, yeah. I mean, but yeah, again, it was, to me, this is the difference between the eye test and stat sheet, because, I mean, in this game, didn't really shoot well, had 7 assists, which was good, but even over the season, he's shooting under 40% from the field, 32 from three. You know, not really getting you high impact defensive plays, turning the ball over a bit, but I can't explain it. He just looks and moves like an NBA player, and has a defined skill set. I really wouldn't be surprised if he continues to get the minutes in Minnesota, if a year or two from now, this is a guy that, you know, I know his plus column is really small around the league, but that will be in a huge plus column for Khan bringing this guy over, because I don't know. I love the guy, and was wishing we could find somebody like that to back up Eric Gordon on this team and be in there for spot starts when Gordon misses time.
Yeah. So I actually thought you were going to go for Dante Cunningham in that game.
He had his moments, but I still think overall, like, he's a poor man's Anthony Davis. I think overall got outplayed by Davis. But, yeah, for the salary, you know, and just the energy that he gave, I enjoyed him. But, I mean, he played 39 minutes in that game, and there was a lot of minutes where I didn't even know he was on the floor. So, good, but, no, Alexei Shved really popped out to me.
Right. All right, is there anything else you want to talk about that game? There's only one thing I have left.
Oh, are you going to talk about? I don't know if we're going to just go with an overall theme with Rivers, so I'll skip on that. But Roger Mason, again, this is coming off of the Houston game, which Roger Mason, I mean, straight out won for us. Again, he comes back in this game, plays solid minutes. You know, doesn't turn the ball over, gets you 10 points on 6 shots, makes both of his threes. I mean, it's nice to have. I mean, that was a huge weak spot on this team. And not only have we made a huge leap with our starting shooting guard, but now, you know, that leap has transferred over to our backup shooting guard, to where this is a position where we've gotten zero production from. And now, it's a, you know, at least over these past couple of games, it's a position where we're getting far above average efficiency from. And so Mason, to me, I think, has to be somewhat applauded for this game.
Yeah, I mean, he's having a really nice effect out there, but I think a lot of that has to do with him not being put into a role that he can't accomplish. I mean, right now he's basically catching and shooting, or catching and making a move to score. And before, he was playing off of Austin Rivers, or playing off of Xavier Henry or Brian Roberts, and really it was those guys made their move, and then they threw the ball to him when it didn't work, and he had to manufacture something. And now he's getting some minutes next to Grievous Vasquez and Eric Gordon, where he could just play off of them and let them do the hard lift, heavy lifting, and then feast on the open shots that are generated. And he's very good at feasting.
Yeah.
He would fit into Game of Thrones well.
Oh, gosh, you had to put it in there.
it's coming out in just a couple months, new season.
Yeah, I mean, I was pleased with that. But, yeah, I figured we would tackle Rivers just overall, because I know that we have some questions from people specifically talking about, you know, how we would feel about him going to the D League. So I think he pretty much played the exact same way in the New York game. So I figured we could tackle him as an overall subject.
Yeah, that's the one other thing I want to talk about, was Rivers getting 5 minutes in this game. And I mean, he was one of the squad thrown in the first quarter, where Monty was like, somebody figure out something here. And he figured out how to turn the ball over twice.
Yeah, I mean, cross-court passes, just...
they were bad. It was just like, I mean, these are like things in high school, you're like, what are you doing?
Yeah, yeah, you could just see that he has no real idea of what his role is supposed to be, or has no real identity as a basketball player. I mean, we thought that, you know, moving him from high minutes to low minutes, where, you know, the pressure would be off, would help him, but it doesn't seem like that's the case at all. If anything, it just seems like he's pressing too hard to do something in those couple of minutes that he's going to get, and when he doesn't, Monty pulls him and never puts him back in.
Yep. Well, I mean, that's the line I just said. He had an assist in that game, and then he goes to New York, he gets one less minute, still manages his two turnovers, no assists.
Yeah, although one of those turnovers, I think, was unfair. Not like this really matters, like all of a sudden we're going to bump him up to an A+. But one of the turnovers, he passed to Ryan Anderson, and Anderson just kind of lackadaisically moved towards the ball and got it in his hand, and it got taken away by Pablo Prigioni for a layup. But yeah, either way, again, not saying that he had a great game, but again, he comes in, he just kind of dribbles the ball around. He's so happy to give it up to somebody else, not even looking to make a move for his own at all. I mean, I think it's something where he's just absolutely lost out there, doesn't know his place on the team. And, you know, this is a question that I wouldn't even consider or brushed off, you know, in the last couple of weeks. But now I can't say that I'm not at least partly intrigued by it. Do you consider, with a fully healthy team, sending Rivers down to the D League?
Not now. But if he continues to have the same sort of results in the limited minutes you're giving him, I think you have to.
So, okay, so first of all, what are your, before we go there, what are your real feelings on the D League? Like, do you think this is a place where people could really be developed? Is it something just to get you confident? Like, how do you feel about the way this league is used?
I think if you're one of the lucky franchises that owns your own D-League team, that you can get a lot of benefit to sending a guy down there, because they're going to be running the same sort of, you know, same sort of plays, because you control what the coach is running. I don't think it does a ton to develop somebody, but there is something to say. If you get somebody a good number of minutes and they get to play and they get to play well, their confidence does go up. I mean, those guys will at least know that, you know, I can still dominate something. So when they reach the NBA, they're willing to attack and take shots. And I think the reason why I would consider Austin Rivers needing to go there is I think he's lost that. I mean, I thought the one reason why I thought Austin Rivers would be fine in this league was because he kept attacking and kept attacking and kept attacking. And yes, the results weren't there, but he was getting free throws. He was getting to the basket, which was setting up, you know, guys to be able to get offensive rebounds, because people were, I mean, he had the moves that were setting up the possibility of success. But now it's he catches the ball, he dribbles it between his legs two or three times, doesn't really make a move, and then passes it off. Or if he does make a move, he tries to go all the way to the rim, which we've seen doesn't work for him. He needs to do that floater. He's not trying it. So he's got to get back to where he's going against guys who are bigger, stronger, faster than what he saw in college, and maybe see if he can do really well against those guys. But right now, I mean, I don't think you want to do that right away. If he just takes a few games to settle in and then maybe he starts figuring it out, and you can play him, like I said, 15 minutes a game, fine. We should do that. It's better for him to be in the NBA doing it with Monty.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. I think this theory of the D League is all nice. I don't buy it. I mean, first of all, Austin Rivers had more people at his high school games than he's going to have at a D League game. Like, I just don't buy this idea that a guy who's been in the national spotlight for this long and played at Duke is all of a sudden going to regain this confidence in essentially what are glorified pickup games. Like, he's really going to think that by scoring on a Maurice Allman type, you know, a couple of nights in a row is all of a sudden going to translate to when he has to go against, you know, Ray Allen and James Harden. Like, I don't buy it. I think it's nice in theory that people think if he gets 35 points in some game that he knows means absolutely nothing, that his confidence is going to come back up. And secondly, like, we only see games, but it's not like he doesn't get a lot of what you're talking about in practice. I mean, he's going against real NBA players when they practice and scrimmage, where if he goes down to the D League, he's playing against guys who obviously aren't good enough to be in the NBA. So I still think that he gets a lot of those same things of figuring out how to get his shot off against NBA guys, running offensive sets, et cetera, in scrimmages at practice. I don't know. I hear this D League thing all the time, but I think it's just a lot of theory that I don't really think translates into practice. I just can't imagine. I don't care if Austin Rivers puts up 80 a game, that all of a sudden this is just going to, you know, lift his confidence up, because his expectations of himself and what he thinks and wants to be in this game are so high. I can't imagine that working, but, you know, who knows?
So you wouldn't send him there?
I really wouldn't. I mean, I admit that I did not expect him to struggle this much, but it's a new role, and I've actually seen him be productive in the NBA game. So it's not like I haven't seen any stretches where he could actually play in this league to where I just buy that he's so overwhelmed. I think there's just a lot of adjustments taking place. I think he's overthinking it too much. And, you know, something will happen in this form, you know, in this setting that he's in right now. I just can't believe he goes to the Iowa Energy and helps them win a couple of games against a bunch of nobodies, and all of a sudden that's the magic he'll cure. I can't buy it.
Okay.
So anyway, on to the next game. I feel like I've gotten that question so much that, you know, I at least wanted to address it. So thanks to people for that. But on to the next game. I mean, obviously having to taste loss for the first time in a while, a little spoiled by that four-game winning streak. But I think before we get to Hornets, let's just go at it right now. Your thoughts of Carmelo in this game?
There are people talking afterwards about how Carmelo just won that game for the Knicks. And, I mean, it's like they didn't pay attention to the, you know, 16 shots he missed. A guy scores 27 points, it takes him 25 shots, whoop-de-doo.
So
I'm not impressed.
Okay, so get away from the stats, but just as a fan watching the game, when Carmelo has the ball in his hands, you're not more afraid or, you know, more worried than you are than when any other Nick touches the ball. You're happy the ball is in his hands because of how inefficient he is.
Actually, in that game, the guy I was most worried about was Chris Copeland. But Carmelo Anthony, I am afraid when the ball is in his hands at certain times, at certain places. And in this game, the ball wasn't in his hands in those places. I mean, if he catches in the post, then I'm pretty much certain my team is going to get ripped by him. But he was catching way out in the two-point line and just squaring up and shooting long twos and long threes, and he wasn't really attacking the basket. He was just taking lazy, stupid shots. And I was like, when he caught it, I was kind of like, yeah, go ahead and shoot. I didn't have any worries about him. But the very first play of the game, he caught the ball on the post, turned around, one dribble, hit the mid-range jumper. I'm like, great, this is going to go again. And he didn't really go back and do that. So
yeah, I mean, I guess it's just this thing where I agree. If I had to say in one sentence why the Knicks won this game, it was their second unit over our second unit, and so Melo wouldn't be there. So I agree there, but I just think from a basketball perspective, like we talk about Chris Copeland, but it's not like he was getting his own offense. The Hornets' defense is, you know, so dramatically different and shifted because of their fear of Carmelo Anthony that I think that, you know, that gets a lot of people their looks. And again, when it comes down to efficiency, I can't just go with pure points per shot. To me, I got to factor in who that player is taking shots away from. So I agree with you on this point when it comes to Rudy Gay, because he's taken away shots from Z-Bo and Marcus Gasol and Mike Conley, who are all efficient scorers. But in this game, the Knicks trotted out a starting lineup of Jason Kidd, James White, Chris Copeland, and Tyson Chandler, along with Carmelo. You know, none of those guys are going to be able to get their own shots or, you know, score by themselves at an efficient level. So in this case, you know, I don't necessarily think that Carmelo's the detriment that we normally talk about with the guy who's 27 points on 25 shots. I actually think, you know, just his presence on the court opened up so many things for the Knicks.
It's possible. I'm still just, he's one of those faux superstars to me still. I mean, I'm not going to say he's not a top 30 player in the NBA and that he shouldn't be the best player on somebody's team. But when all the hype from the game is Carmelo Anthony carries them to victory because he had 27 points, it's like, yeah, well, it would have been a much bigger margin if you'd replaced Carmelo Anthony with a competent scorer.
Yeah, see, I don't agree. I don't think Chris Copeland gets any of his open looks. If you just put, I'm trying to think of like a Nick Batum. Nick Batum doesn't, you know, make the Hornets have all their eyeballs on him, thereby leaving Chris Copeland open. So I disagree. Nick Batum could come in and put up 15 shots and score 21 points, and you say that's so much better. I say that his presence doesn't affect the rest. I mean, because I don't understand how you could make both arguments, because you even said that with Eric Gordon on the floor, even though he was shooting absolutely horribly, that, you know, the Hornets were much better because of his presence on the floor. I mean, isn't that the same case for Carmelo?
Like, again, I am mocking Carmelo Anthony because he's lazy. I mean, and Eric Gordon, I'll mock him when he takes those lazy long jumpers too. But to me, Eric Gordon drives towards the basket on a much larger percentage and creates issues in the defense more than Carmelo does. I really don't think Carmelo is the engine that drives lots of, I mean, and yes, you're right that the Hornets will shade their defense to them. They're going to have one guy, you know, edging over there to try to help on Carmelo if he ever tries to drive. So I'm not saying that he's not going to have an impact, because people do fear his scoring because he can get big numbers. But like the game I just watched today, the Carmelo Anthony game that I saw, my opinion, I liked maybe 6 of the 25 shots he took. I thought those were good shots.
Yeah, no, and the numbers do back you up. I mean, they're plus two in the 40 minutes he's on the court, and then they're plus 11 in the minutes he's off. But I think that brings it back to me, what really lost this game. So the Hornets are up 29-22 at the end of the first. And that's the first thing I want to address is it feels to me like the Hornets, like they win a lot of first quarters, but it feels like they have so many chances to just step on the throat of somebody in the first quarter, and they never do. I thought the Hornets outplayed the Knicks thoroughly in the first quarter. I mean, you're talking about Carmelo, who was, I think, 1-for-8 in that first quarter. They just they thoroughly outplayed the Knicks, but then, you know, Eric Gordon is 1-for-4 in that first quarter on 3-point shots. Ryan Anderson can't hit one. Vasquez, I mean, and they're getting wide open looks. I felt like watching that first quarter, they could be up 15, but it's like the Hornets never, ever pull away. It's like they really begin to focus when their back is on the wall. And I'm just, you know, I would love to see some kind of killer instinct step on a team's throat at the beginning of the game. But I honestly can't remember the last time we've seen that.
Yeah. We haven't. I don't know. In that first quarter, this is weird. His stat line's mediocre at best. Anthony Davis, his plus minus is a minus 15. But that first quarter, I thought it was built on the back of Anthony Davis in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Eric Gordon was going, but Anthony, this is, I can't say this a lot about Anthony, but his motor was running hot in that first quarter. And it was actually really shocking to me. And I think it reads a little bit to Anthony Davis's mentality, which we've brought up. In the fourth quarter, when he came back in and the Hornets were clearly down, like I think they were down 14 at the time, they were probably not coming back, and I think everybody kind of sensed that. Anthony Davis came in and immediately let Amari Stoudemire do whatever he wanted. But and that's, you know, saying something. Letting Amari Stoudemire do anything is kind of ridiculous. Because in the first quarter, he was making anybody he was guarding other than Chris Copeland, because he didn't want to run out to the three-point line, he was just smothering them. He was doing a great job. He was fighting everybody for rebounds. He was getting into, he's tipping things away. He only got one steal in that game, but I counted three different pokeaways that ended up in somebody else's hands.
Right.
So, I mean, he was just everywhere in that first quarter and was really, really good. And then he kind of vanished. What do we take from that?
I think, to me, it's kind of a cliche, and I think people don't think this of Davis because he, you know, was such a defensive star. But, you know, people say give your man the ball every once in a while just to keep him interested in the game. And in that first quarter, like, the Hornets' ball movement was beautiful.
Yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah, there was no of the over-dribbling stuff in the ball. I mean, Robin Lopez.
Lopez had some awesome little drop passes.
I mean, he had two beautiful interior passes, one to Davis for a baseline slam. That ball was just moving, and that's when Davis had his energy. Then, you know, the second unit came in, and then it just carried on throughout the game. Like, I was sick of the Knick announcers saying that the Knicks were playing such great defense, because they weren't. It was bad Hornets offense. But I think that's part of it. I think, you know, you get rewarded on the offensive end, you know, you're just that much more amped up on the defensive end and going to give your focus there. Then all of a sudden the ball stops. It stops finding its way to you. There's no energy on that end. I mean, it's just going to carry over to the defensive end. So I personally thought that's where the game switched. And this is where I go back to Vasquez or Gordon is going to be on the floor, because the beginning of that second quarter, Roberts is essentially initiating the offense, and there's this.
Is that what you called it?
Well, he's initiating the dribbling sequence.
Okay.
There was no offense. And people keep asking me, and I mean, another Twitter question that we have comes from Nick Llewellyn, and he's not the only one. A lot of people ask this about, what is going on with Ryan Anderson? And to me, the biggest part is he's getting put in with this second unit And I just don't understand how you expect him to get in the – I mean, don't get me wrong. He's missing open shots from time to time too. But this second unit with either Roberts or Rivers running the point is just an absolute disaster, and the game completely flips there. The Hornets are running uphill the rest of the game and never catch up.
So, and you actually just brought up something that I decided in this game to watch. And I put a tick mark down on a little notepad I had. Every single time Ryan Anderson would set a pick, flare for a three-pointer, and he was at least open enough that he should have been able to catch and shoot, and nobody even looked at him to pass him the ball. And I had 8 tick marks, and he was out there for 21 minutes tonight.
Yeah.
And all of them, except for one, occurred in the second quarter. And he kept setting those picks, and this is, I mean, and this is like my little pet play too, because it's a very low skill play, and in NBA 2K13, I can execute it and actually make a shot off of it. So it's always set the pick, and then as soon as that pick's set, you sprint along the 3-point line and hope that the point guard will turn, and then you call for the ball and you catch it and you shoot it, and yay, I'm awesome because I can run the same play every single time I go down the court, and I'm on a low setting of difficulty so I can actually make the shot. Ryan Anderson was like, he was running that play beautifully, and he just kept getting open, and they wouldn't even look. Like Roberts, once he goes right around a pick, he doesn't look behind him, and he's not passing behind him. Vasquez has the talent where he'll go right, and he'll just flip it over his head back towards Ryan Anderson because he knows where Ryan Anderson is going. Roberts is not interested. Roberts is interested to see if the waves are going to part so he can go to the basket, or he'll look towards the corner to the guy who's flaring to the corner for a corner three. But what usually happens there is the guy flares to the corner, Roberts realizes, I'm not going anywhere, dribbles for a second, then passes to that guy in the corner, that guy's now covered, that guy has to try to dribble out of trouble. So it's a problem. And, I mean, I'm not going to absolve Ryan Anderson of his issues as well, because he is struggling to hit some of those open shots out there, but since he's not playing next to Gordon or Vasquez as much, I would agree that he's not getting the quality of looks he was getting for a little while.
Yeah, and I mean, and this is the thing with every volume shooter in the history of the NBA. I mean, how many times have we had to read a post on what's wrong with Ray Allen? And all right. Of a sudden he comes. I mean, Ray Allen, the greatest three-point shooter of all time, has had just miserable stretches, and then you kick your way out. Like, this is going to happen with any volume three-point shooter. So that I'm not worried about. But, yeah, it's completely frustrating. And you know what plays always open is when they run the pick and roll with Smith, and then Smith flares to the same side as Anderson, because Smith's about 16 feet out and Ryan Anderson's 22, 23.
Yeah.
Kick the ball to Smith, and then Anderson's man comes slamming down to contest the shot. And Smith has done it a couple of times where he'll catch and then pop out to Rhino if he sees him. But that play is just a play that would be absolutely deadly. And it was a play that I remember was just my favorite play of the 2007-08 Hornets era, where Chris Paul and West would run the pick and pop, pass it to West. Stojakovic's man would come to contest. West would pass it to Stojakovic for an open three. Like, that's there a lot. Smith is just looking for his own shot, and didn't see Rhino a couple of times on that today. But yeah, Smith, another coming off of a great game where we praised him endlessly, 0-for-3. But the surprising part, when I look at his box score, is 7 minutes. Like, where, you know, the Knicks, I know, have Chandler, but you don't need necessarily Lopez out there for 29 minutes. And Davis, like you said, the way he was playing after the first, it's pretty shocking after such a great game to only see 7 minutes from Jason Smith.
Yeah, I have no idea why Jason Smith only got 7 minutes. I really can't figure that one out. I mean, yeah, Davis was being given more minutes because he's playing better. But I didn't think Lopez was playing particularly fantastic, but he still got his 30 minutes. I can't really figure out that game, and just in its entirety was kind of confusing to me, because there wasn't anybody dominating the Hornets in any really real way. And I think Monty was just kind of left scratching his head too. Like, what do I put in here to try to turn this around? Nobody's hitting three. Like, 4 of 23 from threes is pretty awful for a team that's pretty good at shooting. You know who my favorite Nick was in that game?
I mean, I would think a guy that you bashed before in Pablo Prigioni.
I didn't bash him. I bashed his age. He's ancient. He's like 87 years old.
He said he was one of the worst shooters ever brought to an NBA team, that his stats coming over were, I mean, his PER was just abysmal. So
His shooting numbers were pretty bad. They were pretty bad. But in this game, he wasn't shooting, so I don't have that to complain against. The guy, unlike most guards, he always seemed to be eager and ready and just willing to attack anybody off the dribble. And he was always trying to do it sneakily. He's like always trying to like slip up there and then suddenly leap out of nowhere and attack the guy and try to steal the ball. And it didn't have great results, but he just, I'm like, as soon as Austin Rivers came on the court, Austin Rivers turned around, he's dribbling up the ball, and you saw Pablo kind of hiding behind the big man. I don't remember which Hornets big man was kind of, you know, doing the guard thing where they lead the dribbler up the court. Pablo's kind of hiding behind him, and you just see him, like, watching Rivers. And as soon as Rivers look away, Pablo flies in from the side, turnover Rivers.
Yeah.
It was just, he's just looking for those things, and I just love that. I think that's just really sneaky, and I kind of like sneaky people.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you ever played a pickup game against old men, that's my that's the scariest one for me. Just see the 40-something year olds with the goggles. I know the winning streak's about to come to an end when I see them about to come in. But yeah, I did like Prigioni, but I mean the overall theme in this game, I don't know. I'm not necessarily gonna throw the blame at the feet of Monty exclusively, but I didn't get, you know, a lot of the rotations. Like I said, I can't have Roberts running my offense for that long. But to me, where the door was closed finally, is the Hornets went in to that fourth quarter, and they were still within striking distance. They still could have won that game. They're only down five going into the fourth. And Lance Thomas, to me, did an amazing job on Carmelo. Right. Like, that is the guy you want on Carmelo. If this game gets close and we're to the final 5 minutes, where Carmelo's numbers are actually amazing in clutch time, by far over the last 5 years, the best.
And that's because he's trying then. That's the most annoying thing about Carmelo, is if he's focused and he's trying to embarrass you, he could do a really good job of it.
Yeah, Team USA trying the whole time. Yeah, I agree with you. But so anyway, you want Lance Thomas in those minutes. Lance Thomas does a great job on Melo at the end of the third. Hornets come within five. J.R. Smith is threatening to have a Michael Beasley player of the game performance, where he's our MVP despite playing for the other team. Hornets are in it. And then Monty has Roberts out there to run the offense. And he leaves Lance Thomas out there with Steve Novak in Carmelo's position. And Lance loves to play off his guy and kind of help, you know, play help defense, which he could kind of do with Melo because he could close out on Melo and Melo likes to take his dribble before he shoots, whatever. But he can't do that on Novak. All of a sudden, boom, a 13-2 run to start the fourth quarter, and the game is just over. Even though Roger Mason almost pulled us back in that game. But
right.
To me, I've got to say that overall theme was just the poor decision-making with regard to the rotations and the matchups in this game, the minutes, et cetera.
Yeah. I don't disagree. The weird part about this is I'm continuously annoyed by the fact we don't have shooters on the floor at times. You always have at least a shooter. But then, you know, at the beginning of this game when the Hornets were playing so well, I mean, are any of the starting five really a shooter? I mean, Eric Gordon, he hasn't yet to prove that he can shoot at a reasonable rate from deep. Vasquez is a nice set shooter. But nobody else in that starting lineup were great shooters. And they were doing pretty well moving the ball and still attacking. So, I mean, I don't. Maybe I'm just over worrying about that kind of thing. But
yeah, I mean, there was an element of just one of those games to this game, because I mean, Ryan Anderson and Gordon go 2 for 14 for deep, while Prigioni and Chris Copeland go 5 for 9. Like, keep in mind that these are two guys that combined on the season average 1.1 made three-pointers per game on 3.3 attempts. I mean, and they go 5 for 9 in this game, while our two guys go 2 for 14. So there was that part of the element to it. But you said it, and I gotta bring it back. I don't want to be a broken record, but Eric Gordon goes 6 for 8 inside the arc in this game. He gets to the line when he drives to the basket. I mean, you can argue that 19 of his points come on eight shots, you know, just inside the arc and driving to the basket. And then he settles for and shoots a lot of those threes, is 1 for 6 from three. Like, he is a very bad, not average, not below average, for a shooting guard, he is a bad to horrible three-point shooter, yet he's still taking a lot of them.
All right, you're going a little overboard.
So wait, statistics.
For his career, which includes these, he's a 36.5% three-point shooter.
Okay, now look
which is right about average.
Now look at those numbers look at those numbers from recent years.
Yeah, well, I mean, right. So as a Hornet, he has not shot well. I'm not disagreeing with that. But, I mean, he's only played 15 games as a Hornet.
But it's gone down every year. He came into the league at 39, then 37, then 36, then 25, now 15. Like, recent history says that, I mean, the position is called shooting guard. So, you know, you have a lot of guys who could do just that. I'm saying purely for his position, he is definitely on the bad to horrible spectrum in that one specific skill set from what we've seen over the last 3 years. But
I have a feeling that he is not a good off-the-dribble shooter, and that's always been the case. And in previous seasons, he's been shooting off of somebody else's creation. And so it would be nice to see him take those kinds of shots more than his pull-up ones. And I'm not going to disagree. I mean, when he pulls up at the three-point line and takes a shot, I'm always like, oh, great. I never think it's going in. And I even feel like when Grievous Vasquez takes a shot, I'm like, that's a good chance going in. I'm not upset if he pulls up at the three-point line. But Eric Gordon, yeah, not a good thing.
And I just want to bring up one other thing about Gordon that I noticed in this game. I mean, there was a lot of good, but this kind of ties back to my missing piece, you know, thing with when it comes to the draft and just overall, if the Hornets are going to look to upgrade from Vasquez, the type of guy that they need, when Gordon rotates over down onto bigs, or, you know, just when the rotations demand that he is somewhere in the paint, he's an absolute non-factor. I mean, guys shoot right over him. And normally, if you have a 6'5", 6'5", 6'6", shooting guard with some athleticism, they could contest at the rim, or, you know, at least make it somewhat difficult for a big guy when, you know, that rotation is made. But Gordon, I mean, just size-wise and athleticism, you know, offers essentially, it's like having another point guard on the court. I mean, there was a play where it was a give and go with J.R. Smith, where Smith passed it, cut to the basket, and they just, you know, lobbed it over Gordon's head as if, you know, he was, you know, 5-6 inches tall. Smith caught it with ease and went up. And it's just something that I noticed in this game, where I know a lot of people love this guy, Trey Burke out of Michigan, who's 6 feet tall. But to me, you're almost always going to have a decent-sized guard on the court with, you know, alongside Eric Gordon. I just can't imagine, you know, a 6 foot, 6 foot one guard and Eric Gordon playing in this backcourt together and not being just absolutely overwhelmed and dominated at times.
And, I mean, you're thinking of it from the point of view of, like, a starting backcourt or a long minutes backcourt. But, I mean, Trey Burke, from what I understand, is probably like a late lottery talent at best, right?
Just because of size. I mean, if he was 6'3", we would be talking top five pick. He's in the running. He's definitely in the top three for player of the year right now in college basketball. He is phenomenal. If you put 3 inches on the guy, he would be in that first tier where he would be a surefire top five pick. He's a step below Chris Paul, but in a lot of the ways does a lot of the same things he did in intangibles, just kind of a poor man's version, but he's 6'4".
Well, but I mean, here's the way, I like to think about it at least is you would get him next year. If we pick him like 10th or 11th, if we end up with that pick, same pick we got, with from Minnesota last year, if you pick him with the 10th pick, you don't really expect him to come in and be a starting guard right away. And wouldn't he be a massive upgrade over Brian Roberts?
Yeah. But again, I mean, if you are, I guess what I'm saying is, yeah, he'd be an upgrade over Brian Roberts. But if you're talking about choosing between him and like an Otto Porter for your small forward of the future, Porter right. could play and start at the position. I guess I'm just saying that was something that stood out to me from this game is that the Hornets play a lot of help defense. They rotate a lot, and oftentimes that is going to put you in a position where you have mismatches. Like and Chris Paul was a small guy, but he was stocky. So when he got mismatches, he could fight and claw, and he had incredibly quick hands, so he could get the steal from a big guy when, in cases where that happened every once in a while. Eric Gordon is just, he's an amazing on-ball defender, but when it comes to disrupting anything in the paint or, really being able to keep certain guys out or contest their shots, like, he is essentially like having an average point guard there on those help rotations.
Yeah, he just swipes the ball and gets out of the way.
Yeah.
So, he hopes he can maybe dart loose. That's about it.
Right. So just something, to keep in mind long term. I really love the fact that Vasquez is out there because, as we said in the past, on offense, Vasquez really helps with sealing off bigger guys. On defense, he's a big body that could go into the paint and help rebound, something that, Eric Gordon's just not going to ever be able to do or really wants to do. So yeah, just something that popped out in this game to kind of keep in mind.
So here's the ultimate question for you.
Oh, the ultimate.
And it's going to be the easiest ultimate question you've ever answered. If the NBA came to you and said, we would create a salary slot for you, specifically.
For Michael McNamara?
That does not, for your team, that does not count against your cap. Or your luxury tax, or anything. It's just a free slot, $20 million, and you have that slot open. You can put any player you want into it, and you're the only team that has it. And New York comes to you and says, "You want Amari Stoudemire? Is there any way you would take him?"
I don't. Okay. So this is hard. So what I think by far is the biggest deficiency on this team and something that we have to fill is I say to you, okay, we need to get some offense initiated in the post. Who's the first guy that pops to your name on this Hornets team?
Offense in the post, Robin Lopez.
Like you consider him a post option where you could just dump the ball down and he's going to make something work more time.
Sometimes. Do you think there's somebody who's a better post offensive option on this team?
I don't. That's my point. So where I at least, if you're telling me that it doesn't count against my cap at all, he would be our best post player. So yeah, I think at times, this team,
wow.
Jerry V, he points it out. Basically this team wins when it hits its threes, but it's a horrible 2-point shooting team because the easiest and most, repeatable 2-point shot that you could be efficient with is you know, is in the post. Like, I love Jason Smith, but to me, this team would be better with Carl Landry than Jason Smith, because it's just a dimension that these Hornets don't have at all. We have enough shooters, you know, we have enough pick and pop guys, enough 3-point guys. I mean, I just, if to me you're saying the best option in the post is Robin Lopez, and actually I honestly think it's Grievous Vasquez, which is even scarier, then again, if essentially in your scenario it's like adding what in real life would be a minimum salary guy, yeah, I would love that just for the nights where my jumper's off. I would have somebody, you know, that I could throw down in the post and maybe get something.
I'm sorry. I can't do that. I mean, and tonight he even had an efficient game. I'm like looking at this line and I'm like, 12 points on 6 shots. I should love this guy. I mean, even if only 3 rebounds in 23 minutes, that's a nice efficient offensive game. But the guy just plays stupid basketball. When he was in Phoenix, he played stupid basketball. He was magnificent because he could play off of a very intelligent player who got him shots where he wouldn't make stupid mistakes. I mean, on defense, there are 3 separate plays on defense where it was just boneheaded errors, the kind of errors that if Aminu made any of those, he would be pulled immediately. Just, I'm going to push a guy who's 22 feet away from the basket and is dribbling away from the basket. He's not even like a threat to score, and I'm going to give him a little push because I might maybe jar the ball. You don't even know what he's thinking. And he does that all the time.
See, I think that you evaluate him so harshly because he is a $100 million player. Like, you know how many horrible players there are on other teams that you never even watch for or have any expectations for because of their contract? So I just, for a $100 million player, you are correct. But in your scenario, essentially I'm bringing him in on what the equivalent is of a minimum contract. If any team could get Amari for a minimum contract, they would be insane not to. A minimum contract? I mean, we just brought Donald Sloan in. You want Donald Sloan over Amari? Come on. Let's get real here.
Okay.
So yeah, I mean, just overall in this game, I mean, it was one that we both expected to lose. I think it's just one of those, okay, moving on from – type of game. So let's do just that. Moving on. This East Coast swing continues, going against 2 teams kind of going in opposite directions. Philadelphia not winning much of late. Boston starting to look like the team that maybe people expected them to be before the season started. Which one do you want to talk about?
I'll take Boston. I'll let you open with Philly.
All right. So Philadelphia, I mean, essentially you're looking at a team that's, I mean, they're out of the playoff chase, which, you know, when they traded for, or outside of the playoffs right now, looking in, when they traded for Andrew Bynum, I thought a lot of people were saying this is kind of a dark horse in the Eastern Conference, haven't really been playing well. Obviously he hasn't played at all, but, you know, just a team that's very, very perimeter oriented. I mean, obviously, they have Jrue Holiday as their best player. And actually, what they do a lot is they slide Evan Turner into that point guard role when Holiday's off the bench. I mean, essentially, one of them is running the offense at all times. And it seems to me, I mean, I was just looking over kind of their lineups and what's effective and what's not. Their 2 heaviest lineups both involve kind of the same starting 4 guys with Holiday, Evan Turner, Thaddeus Young, and Lavoie Allen. He's actually getting the bulk of their minutes at center, despite the fact they have Spencer Hawes, and they made that brilliant signing for Kwame Brown, where essentially they amnestied Elton Brand to bring Kwame Brown in. But the guy they're giving most of the minutes to at center is Lavoie Allen, and they have 2 different you know, guys that they pair with those 4, you know, and that rotation gets the heaviest minutes. One is that lineup with Jason Richardson, and one is that lineup with Darrell Wright. And the version with Jason Richardson is and has been incredibly efficient, has outscored their opponents by about 7.5 points per 100 possessions, while that exact same lineup with Darrell Wright in place of Jason Richardson has actually been outscored by over 5 per 100 possessions. So, these are the two lineups that they trot out the most often. And when Richardson's on the court, it seems to really, even more so than Wright, open up their offense. And that starting lineup has actually been very good. It's when they start to go to their bench and kind of tinker with different lineups and put Evan Turner at point guard that they really start to struggle. So I just think going into this game, if the Hornets could kind of play even or, even outperform their starters, I think there's a lot of things to like in this game where they could come out with a victory. I mean, Philly doesn't really crash the offensive boards. They don't get to the line. They get to the line less than anybody else in the league by percentage. They play at a pace that, is pretty much the same as what the Hornets play at with Eric Gordon. So that should put the Hornets in their comfort zone. And, really, they don't have a lot of offense to speak of. So for a lot of reasons, I see this as a very winnable game for the Hornets.
Yeah. So if you just run down, you mentioned this, they don't have a lot of efficient offense. You run down the list of their players, they don't have a single guy on this team other than Royal Ivy and his, 20 games and 11 minutes a game, who is even averaging 1.2 points per shot. Every other player is shooting worse than that. And to put that in perspective, I mean, the Hornets, when they had Chris Paul on the team, usually had 4 to 5 players who were shooting 1.2 or better. David West usually is around 1.27. Paul was usually around 1.4. And then they usually had a couple shooters who were above 1.2. So even their shooters, and that's what a shooter's specialty is, hitting three-point shots is supposed to put you over the top and make you be able to get efficient points. Even their shooters aren't doing that. Darrell Wright and Jason Richardson, the two you mentioned, they're just not shooting particularly efficiently, and they're getting no free throws at all. But here's the one guy I wanted to bring up. Evan Turner is another one of those guys whose story has completely obscured the fact of just how bad of a basketball player he still is. Because he was the guy who was picked second. He had amazing college stats. He was supposed to come in and be a superstar, and he was a disappointment. And then he was a disappointment again. And then they were like, all right, we're going to trade Andre Iguodala, and Evan Turner is going to come in, and he's going to take over that role, and we'll see what he got. And people look at his stat line, and they're like, okay, Andre Iguodala was like a guy who's 13-6-4. That was what he was last year. And now they look at Evan Turner, and he's 13-6-4. And they're like, perfect. Evan Turner is as good as Andre Iguodala. He's filled that role. He's grown into it. He's amazing. Let's all worship Evan Turner now. And the reality is Evan Turner is not anything close to Andre Iguodala. He's not the defender he is. He doesn't have anywhere the steals, anywhere near the blocks. His turnovers are higher. His shooting, he doesn't draw any free throws, and that was Andre Iguodala's primary offensive ability, was getting to the line like 4 or 5 times a game. Evan Turner gets there 2.5 times a game. He's just not a great basketball player. So don't fall into that trap. When people talk about it, it's not true. It's a false.
Oh, why are you doing that? Every time you bash a guy on this podcast,
he's going to torch us, isn't he?
Awesome. I mean, whether it's for us or whether, I mean, why can't you be saying these same things about Eric Gordon so he goes off in this game? Instead, you're just going to tease Evan Turner, and now he's going to go off. No, I agree a lot. I mean, I will say that, again, the one place where Evan Turner is slightly better than Iguodala is just, as a playmaker, he can slide down to the point and at least be, somewhat decent. He rebounds well for his position, but it's honestly because he's probably somewhat out of position. I think I would say he's more of a point forward than a shooting guard, but he does rebound fairly well for his position. This team really, it's going to be, and what happened the last time these two met was, Drew Holiday just with the massive quickness advantage over Eric Gordon. I honestly think the Hornets match up better putting or over Vasquez. I actually think the Hornets match up better putting Gordon on Holiday and Vasquez on Turner. I'd like to see some of that in this game, but I really think that the Hornets could, you know, shut down this team offensively, and where Philadelphia has really fell off. I mean, this is a team that has gone 4-13 in their last 17 games. So, I mean, multiple five-game losing streaks this month. Where they really fell off is on the defensive end. I mean, some of these losses, you know, they had three straight losses that were by 20 points or more just last week. They're not just losing. They're getting blown out because their offense is as bad as it ever has been, you know, combined with the fact that they're just giving up tons of points. So, yeah, I think this is a game that the Hornets could take. There's really not much I'm afraid of. It could always become one of those games, again, with somebody like Nick Young, where he could just decide tonight's going to be his night, where he's going to go off. But, you know, with their small forward position, I don't see a lot of those backdoor cuts torturing Aminu. I think the Hornets control the defensive glass, so I'll just go out right out and say it. I got Hornets by 7 in this one on the road.
Okay, I actually had the exact same number, Hornets by 7. I have one further question for you about this team, because in the past, when we've been talking trades, there's always been like a couple guys who've intrigued me in the Philadelphia 76ers. Darrell Wright, I've always kind of liked. I've always liked Thad Young, though. He's a little maybe overpaid. But if the Hornet, if you were, you know, general man, if you're Del Demps, being Del Demps again, and you're looking around the league trying to identify a player to try to just put out feelers, try to go after, not someone that, you know, that you're going to, like, go all out to get, but someone who, if you can manage to pull them in for a reasonable price, other than Drew Holiday, who clearly would fit a need pretty drastically, is there anybody on this team that you would say, yeah, that's a guy I'd keep my eye on and I'd hope he became available?
This guy I don't think will become available because I think the Sixers value him as much as they should. But to me, it would be a guy that I talked about earlier in Lavoy Allen. Like, I just love guys like that. You always make fun of me for loving the Reggie Evans of the world. But, like, I think Reggie Evans had, like, didn't he have, like, 30 rebounds the other night or something?
He had a big number. I don't think it was 30.
It was pretty close, but yeah. I love guys. I love Lavoy. He would be the one, but I think the Sixers are right there with me, so he wouldn't become available. Like, Darrell Wright, it would be no just because this is his last year of a deal. Quite honestly, as the Hornets, I'm not going anywhere this year, so I'm not looking for a one-year upgrade. I want to see what I have in Aminu this year. And, you know, I wouldn't want him because there's guys that I like a little more on the free agent market in Corey Brewer and Chase Buttinger this summer. So, you know, I guess if I was trying to win this year, it would be Darrell Wright, but, you know, that's obviously not happened for the Hornets. So really just Lavoy Allen. How about you?
I always want to say Thad Young, but when I think about our team, he's not a small forward. He's listed as a small forward. He's really a small ball power forward who can swing the small forward sometimes and play there. And while he's a clear upgrade over what Aminu will give you from that, I wouldn't try to, like, give a reasonable price for him. If he was on the market for, you know, peanuts, then you snap him up. But I don't think there's anybody on this team who I would really go after, which is a little surprising.
Yeah.
I guess you're right. I do kind of like Lavoy Allen. And then we could be on the Lavoy boat.
Nice.
Ba-dum-bum.
The Lavoy boat.
Thanks for selling that because it was pretty bad.
I'm a big Thaddeus Young fan, and I just wonder. I mean, I do wonder how Thaddeus Young, Ryan Anderson, and Davis would look next to each other because, again, you've got a four who plays more like a three in Anderson, and then you have a three who plays more like a four in Thaddeus Young. I really wonder if they could make it work. I mean, defensively, would you be terrified to have Thaddeus Young against most threes in the league? I wouldn't.
No. No, I wouldn't at all. I think he's pretty good at swinging to the small forward of his defense.
I mean, I think he's a rich man's Al-Farouq Aminu, so it would be an upgrade, but you're right. When it comes to salary, could you get a better fit and use that salary better than just saying, I'll take a square peg and put it, you know, a very nice square peg and put it in a round hole? Might it be better to build the team a little differently? But, yeah, as far as, I mean, I think Thaddeus Young and Jrue Holiday are far and away the two best players on this 76ers team. It's not even close.
All right. So we're thinking Hornets will win. I love it how we like sit here and like talk down to the teams, and you know, anybody else who's like listening to this who's not like a Hornets fan is probably like, they're crazy. The Hornets team sucks. But just you watch.
Yeah, 5-2 with Eric Gordon this year. So,
so we're moving on. Now it's a back to back. So the first thing I wonder about this game against Boston is Eric Gordon going to play? They were in the last game, not New York, but against Minnesota, they actually mentioned that they were still wondering if Eric Gordon would be strong enough to play in back-to-back games, which just the fact that they're saying that makes me think, great, they're going to keep Eric Gordon out of the Boston game. But if he plays, then he, of course, makes this game a whole lot more interesting. Boston... They very heavily misjudged how much they are going to miss Ray Allen. And I guess that's me being unfair to them, because Ray Allen didn't want to stay in Boston. Ray Allen was offered a bigger deal from Boston than what he got in Miami, and he ran to Miami anyways. So, but they tried to replace him with a couple of players, Jason Terry and Courtney Lee, guys who have reputations as D and 3 kind of players, and neither of them have really worked out the way they were hoping. Jason Terry has not been shooting particularly well from three. He's always been more of a slashing mid-range guard anyways than the three-point shooter, and that's pretty much showing. Courtney Lee has had one of his worst seasons shooting the ball in his entire run in the league. So the two of them haven't worked out particularly well. Their other big offseason acquisition, which everybody was who likes advanced stats kind of, you know, cocked an eyebrow over, like, really, was Jeff Green. He's not helping you from three, shooting 32%. He's not helping you really anywhere because he doesn't rebound the ball. He doesn't block shots. He doesn't steal. He doesn't shoot well. He's kind of poor. So basically they've turned into the Paul Pierce, Kevin Garnett, Rajon Rondo show even more dramatically than they were before. Kevin Garnett's also had to be limited. He's getting older, and Doc Rivers has wisely kept him at 29 minutes a game this year. So that intense Kevin Garnett energy isn't out there on the floor all the time, and that's, of course, resulted in Boston being where they are. They're 19-17. They're barely above 500. But they've had a little bit of a run recently where they've been playing better, and I'm probably oversimplifying a little bit, but it's my boy, Jared Solinger, has come on really strong. He had a month and a half where he was bad. He couldn't hit a shot. His rebounding was mediocre. He just had a really rough go of it out there for his first month and a half in the NBA. But over the last 3 or 4 weeks, he's figured it out. He's been rebounding a lot stronger. He's figured out how to get his shot off over bigger guys. And, I mean, he's been helping them out a lot. And the most bizarre thing I can say about this team is, other than Paul Pierce, and I guess if you want to call Varnando, who only played one game, other than Paul Pierce, he's their most efficient scorer now.
Yeah, I mean, he has more total rebounds than any other player, offensive rebounds than any other player on the team, and he only gets 19 a game. So, yeah, and I mean, talk about playing bad. Obviously, you know, let it be known I'm a fan of Bill Simmons. Listen to his BS report every Tuesday when I'm at the gym. And Jared Solinger is a guy that, you know, up until about 2-3 weeks ago, Bill Simmons was begging and trying to put in any trade possible, you know, just basically saying that this is a guy who's not going to be an NBA player. And he's turned it on of late. But, yeah, I see. And this is where the small sample size rush to judgment comes in overall as a team. I mean, the Celtics are 5-0 in their last five games. Four of the teams that they've beaten are playoff teams, including at Atlanta and at New York. I mean, It hasn't been an easy schedule. They've gone 5-0. They're winning by over 11 points per game in the stretch. Like, I think people expect for a team just to get all of these parts and all of a sudden just throw them together. When you look at it, I mean,
it's a new team.
Yeah, I mean, Jason Terry, Jeff Green, Courtney Lee, Jared Solinger, Leandro Barboza. Like, out of their top nine, five guys are, you know, new to the team. Obviously, Green was there, but he didn't play last year. But, you know, and then now working Avery Bradley back in, which, you know, is no coincidence. Now, people...
I was waiting for you to do
people,
it.
People who just look at box scores will say, yeah, but, you know, Avery Bradley isn't really doing anything that great offensively. His numbers aren't... But, you know, I've told anybody who listens... I mean, Avery Bradley was Eric Bledsoe before Eric Bledsoe this year. You want to talk about a guy who people were saying, man, look at this on-the-ball defense this guy plays. He could score out in transition, hit the occasional corner three. Like, people were in love with Avery Bradley before his injury. He was that to the Celtics last year. I mean, they just put Avery Bradley on Dwayne Wade, and Dwayne Wade had fits, and he came back. So again, if you're really talking about their 10-man rotation, essentially six of those guys are new in some ways or form, and now they're just starting to put it together. And yeah, with this being the second game of a back-to-back on an East Coast road trip, nothing really to play for this season, and Eric Gordon's, you know, injury history, I sit him down, and if the backups win this game, good for them, but I'd be more than fine walking out of here 1-1 over these two games.
Yeah, I was waiting for you to bring up Avery Bradley. I was trying to, like, of course, pump up my my Jared Solinger. He's my guy. I wanted him in the draft, man. and that, you know, try to give him all the credit. But you're right, Avery Bradley entering this team, he makes a huge difference. You look at his plus minuses from last year, and they're obscene. And he's not a great offensive player, but yeah, defensively, every bit of quickness you could ever want in an NBA player resides in Avery Bradley. So, the only other mention I wanted to bring out about this team before I make my prediction, it seems like, well, for 5-6 years. Whenever we talked about wanting to get a power forward for the Hornets, somebody brought up bringing Brandon Bass back. And I've never been that impressed with Brandon Bass. This year, Brandon Bass is awful, beyond awful. And I hope nobody talks about trading for Brandon Bass this year at all. I'd just like to get through the season without hearing any Brandon Bass mention at all. Even if he goes off against us, scores 18 points and has 10 rebounds in this upcoming game, I don't want to hear anything about Brandon Bass.
I don't think you will, because I don't think it's a position in need. So, I agree, although I will say that system and Kevin Garnett specifically does some weird things to those guys' heads. I mean, Glenn Davis was playing fine before he got injured when he went to Orlando, and it looked like, you know, he was an absolute mess in Boston. So maybe the same could be said for Brandon Bass, but I don't want to find out. I guess long story short, end of this game, I don't expect Eric Gordon to play. I really don't see any reason for it. So I'm going Celtics by 13 in this one. And I'm hoping Austin Rivers gets the start, and maybe Doc lays off him a little bit. And he could get going in this game in Boston, where he would, you know, add some familiar surroundings.
Maybe Doc will let Avery Bradley sit down and he won't torture his son with him.
Yeah. Yeah, Doc. Put Leandro Barboza on him instead.
Yeah. I don't care if Gordon is playing or not. I say Boston wins. If Gordon is playing, I think Boston takes it by a good 6 or 7. If Gordon's not playing it, then I think 10 is the number I would go for.
So
and yes, Eric Gordon's worth 4 points. So that's what I mean by that.
Would you play Eric Gordon with the season where it is and, you know, doctors' recommendations being what they've been? I mean, would you even entertain playing Eric Gordon in this game?
if the doctors are saying that he should not play back to backs, I would sit him down. I would sit him down and I wouldn't really care. Because, like you said, the Hornets aren't playing for anything here. I mean, I like to sit here and fantasize as much as the next guy about the Hornets being able to play 800 ball, win four, lose one, win four, lose one, and somehow sneak into the playoffs. But it's not happening. So
not happening.
It's not happening.
Yeah.
Get Eric Gordon healthy. That's more important, especially if Eric Gordon is, you know, a key to this team going forward for the next 4 years, which is what it sounds like, you know, the team is thinking.
Yeah.
Then, yeah, I mean, absolutely, health is way more important than a random back-to-back game against Boston.
Yeah, and after this game, the Hornets don't have another back-to-back for two more weeks. So, you know, again, I don't see the point. I know as fans we like to win every game, and, you know, there's still that outside chance that if teams like the Lakers and, you know, Portland start falling, apparently Steph Curry is hobbling around with an injury in tonight's game, ankle injury. I'll give you a second to put your surprised face on. You know, maybe they fall back to the pack, but quite honestly, it's just not going to happen. So I sit him for this game. But that brings me to a question. We've seen some games now. This guy, you know, has asked me 2 weeks in a row. I would like to get your perspective on this. Shout out to Hamptonis, but he asks, say there's some scenario where you could guarantee Eric Gordon forever being injured, so take injury out of it, how many shooting guards would you take over him? And I'm guessing he means, you know, both short-term and long-term, but essentially we're in the NBA 2K13 fantasy draft, you got your league, you shut injuries off. How many shooting guards in this league would you take over Eric Gordon right now?
Huh. Well, I mean, I would say Dwayne Wade, although I'm not sure he'll be as good in 4 years as Eric Gordon will be. So that one's shaky. I'm not taking Kobe over him because Kobe's going to continue to get older and slower.
And Bet, apparently, because he's having one of his best years. I mean, I need to go to these German doctors for something.
It is bizarre what he's doing this year, but, I mean, I expect this to be more of a fluke year, and I may be the dumbest person on earth for saying that and expecting that. But, you know, I'm having a hard time thinking of players who I like tremendously more than Gordon. Give me 1 second to think about this.
James Harden.
Well, yeah, I mean, I would go with James Harden. I think that's the only one.
So Eric Gordon would be the second player off the board in your,
As a shooting guard,
he would be the second shooting guard off the board in a long-term fantasy draft for you.
Yeah. I mean, so, the only other shooting guard I think I like better than Gordon is probably Manu, and we know Manu's not going to keep playing at the level he is.
Yeah, and even he's come down a little bit, and yeah, but the injuries off would help Manu too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, by salary, I'd have to go with Joe Johnson, though.
Oh, of course. yeah, I mean, he has hit. I wonder if Nets fans feel the same way, because Joe Johnson hasn't played well, but I think he leads the team in game-winning shots, so I wonder how much cachet that has.
If I had to just pick for this year, my of course my thing would be a little bit different. I'd probably have four different players in front of Eric Gordon, but other than that, just like for the length of his contract that exists, is 4 years. Gordon's second on my list.
Nice. Bob Morrell asks again. I guess we could take Eric Gordon off this, but this is so nice to have a completely healthy team to see the team that Dell envisioned, you know, when he put it together this offseason, it's been enjoyable to watch, but you know that the injury bug is not going to stay away for the entire year, even if it's just 1 to 2 week injuries. Guys are going to get banged up again. Take Eric Gordon off the list. We've already seen his impact when he goes out. Other than Eric Gordon, which player would you fear being injured the most? Which would be most difficult for the team to win without?
Grievous Vasquez.
Okay.
And, of course, I'm a hater of Grievous Vasquez. So everybody is probably shocked that I would say such a thing. But, I mean, that's just pure, what would we bring in behind Grievous Vasquez? It would be a disaster. I mean, there isn't a person who brings any other than Eric Gordon who can't play both positions for 48 minutes game. I mean, Vasquez is the only guy who can start get shots for other players in this offense. And it's that simple. I mean, I would, if Gordon and Vasquez both got injured, I don't know if I could watch Hornets basketball.
Huh.
That's not true. I'd watch Hornets basketball anyways. But, I mean, I'd probably, you know, end up stabbing myself in the eyeball at some point.
Okay.
Do you have a different answer than me?
It would be Vasquez just because, again, I could my starting lineup would then be Gordon and Mason. I would shift Gordon over to the point, so I could be fine with that, but what happens in the 12 to 18 minutes that Gordon is off? Yeah, that would be tough. The only other one, I guess would be Ryan Anderson, just because of how much he spaces the court and how hard it is to get this offense going without that floor spacing at times. So that would be the only other one. And then the one that I fear just from a long-term perspective, again, is Anthony Davis. Like, if he went out with a season-ending injury, okay, I'm knocking on wood right now. I would hate to be blamed for this too. But if he goes out with a season-ending injury and we just lose, you know, all that time where he could be learning on the court, that would hurt, I guess, from a long-term perspective if we're talking about viewing it that way. But just pure wins and losses, I agree, Grievous Vasquez.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying that Grievous Vasquez is the behind Eric Gordon the best player on this team. I think Ryan Anderson is the second-best player on this team, and I think Anthony Davis is close to being the third-best player on the team. He's got a little bit of work to do still, but he's right there.
So I mean, Vasquez has been playing better of late. Eric Bledsoe really hasn't. I mean, has it remade you think anything? Would you trade Vasquez and the first round pick right now today for Eric Bledsoe?
I'd hesitate and then say yes.
Yeah, see, we're hesitating about it.
Which is bizarre.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, Vasquez is playing better. He's less turnover prone. I mean, today he had four, so I can't say he's perfect.
Right.
But, you know, I mean, the one thing that I worry about Bledsoe is I don't know if he's going to be able to score as well as he is when he's not the third or fourth. You know, basically he's the third or fourth person on the court when he plays. There's always others. There's always Jamal Crawford out there with him. There's Caron Butler out there with him. There are guys that other teams have to respect all the time. If you're putting the ball in his hands and saying, you are the one and only terror on the court other than a few spot-up shooters, I think Bledsoe might have some trouble.
Yeah. Now, how about Vasquez in that first for either Jennings or Lowry, and they agree to extension, so don't worry about that. But
and the first?
So Vasquez in the first for Jennings, Vasquez in the first for Lowry.
I don't think I would do that.
Wow. So wait, you value Bledsoe over those guys?
Yeah.
Really?
Maybe not Lowry. Lowry's really... I guess Lowry with an extension, I would take Lowry.
So your list would go Lowry, Bledsoe, sounds like Jennings, Vasquez, as far as just...
No. Keep the first round pick in there. If it's just pure players, I would take any of those three over Vasquez.
Right, that's what I said. I said Lowry, Bledsoe, Jennings, Vasquez.
Yes.
Okay, but so the first round pick is too much to go up to Jennings. Interesting. And would you give our first round pick up today? This was my – I'm starting a new tweet of the day where it's called the we're losing ping pong balls every day. We need to trade the pick now, trade of the day. And essentially I traded our first rounder for Chandler Parsons in a three-way deal. Would you do that?
It's really that long? I don't think that's going to –
It barely fits in
character-wise. Really? That's a big
Well, because I put all the words together. Well, whatever.
So first round pick for Chandler Parsons.
Yep. Let me tell you, his contract is 3 years, $2.9 million, including this year. So you have...
Total or per year?
Total. You have him for two...
Oh, that's right, because he was...
You have him for two more years at under $1 million per year. So you lock up your small forward of the future, and you would still have over $15 million going into this free agent class.
Yeah, I think I'd do that.
Yeah. All right.
It's close, though. That's about... I think I would do it.
Last one, Eric Gordon and fillers for Rudy Gay and Tony Allen. Oh, he's hesitating again.
Rudy Gay and Tony Allen?
Yeah, Eric Gordon.
How long does Rudy Gay's contract go? Another 2 years, doesn't it?
Yeah, but it'll be up before we start to...
Yeah, I know, before we have to start worrying about Anthony Davis' extension. Rudy Gay's in that trade. But Eric Gordon's going to get injured again. See, this is my problem, because now I'm thinking, now Eric Gordon's playing, so all of those days of pain where there's no Eric Gordon.
It's so tough, and to me, what really got me was this news of Greg Oden coming back. Henry Abbott did a great piece on Oden's time in Portland, and it was the same thing. It was Oden would miss time. But and people still say, how could Portland have chosen Oden over Durant?
He's amazing.
When Oden was on the court, Portland, their numbers were championship, not playoff caliber, championship caliber. I mean, we're talking about stretches where when he was on the court, Portland outscored opponents by an additional 10 points per 100 possessions. Like, yeah. He was a monster. So this is what made it impossible for Portland to ever trade him. Because he'd be out all this time, you'd get mad, you'd say, oh, I just want to be rid of it. Then he would come back and play for 20 games, and you would have a championship-caliber team with him. How can you possibly trade that? Then he would get injured again, and now he has no trade value. So this is why it's just absolutely impossible, because you get stuck and lost in the moment, and you just hope that he never gets hurt again because you're so good with him. But again, to balance out the sides of the argument, imagine if Portland did have the balls to have traded him even when he was playing so well and they were playing well with him and got something rather than nothing back. I mean, it's so tough to do. And I just think that a GM is always going to err on the side of caution, because if you play the worst case scenario game, if he trades Eric Gordon now – and Eric Gordon blows up, and by blows up, plays good, not gets fat again. if he plays well, then that's a fireable offense.
Yeah.
I mean, you could get fired for that. If Eric Gordon just continues to keep getting hurt, you could throw your hands up and be like, well, I couldn't have done anything about it, and play the victim, and you don't necessarily lose your job. So I just think a GM is almost always going to err on the side of caution in that scenario, but I keep thinking about what if the Blazers would have been ballsy enough to dump Greg Oden and gotten value for him, but who knows?
Yeah, I'm still dwelling on your trade. I love Tony Allen.
Yeah, but he's a free agent after this year, so you would have to re-sign him, and that might be hard to do with Rick Gay eating up your cap like Pac-Man does pellets, so...
Yeah. I don't know. That'd be a really hard one. That offer would go on the table, and I'd just be staring at it, thinking.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. There was Mark Stein did report rumblings from Reno this week. Apparently, he was told by one person that the Hornets have made Gordon available, and then the Hornets source said, no, that's not true at all. People have inquired about him, but we are not, we have not made him available. So, it's an interesting thing to at least follow, but yeah, for all of those, look at how great he's playing. We could never get rid of him. I just keep thinking back to Portland and Oden and hope it's not the case, but it's not rocket science. When we talked about Anderson Varejao, what did we say? Well, this guy gets hurt all the time. Cavs should trade him before he gets hurt again. What happened? Varejao got hurt again. Stephen Curry has an ankle injury tonight. I don't know how serious it is. I haven't checked. but he goes down with an ankle injury tonight. To think that the guys who always get hurt don't get hurt again, I just don't believe it. And so we'll see.
You're so depressing.
I know. Let's end it with some optimism. What can we do?
Some optimism? you've run me into Game of Thrones is coming out in 2 months.
Okay, Girls is back on HBO. Decent show.
American Idol's supposed to start soon,
I guess.
And I'm not sure I'm going to watch it.
And apparently, I mean, you can see that we're doing this, you know, as we go. Apparently, it looks like Jodie Foster just had some kind of epic Golden Globes moment that everybody's talking about. So maybe that's surprising. Gosh, I've got to see something positive. I hate ending on negative Eric Gordon note.
The Hornets have won 4 out of 5 games.
I like it.
And if they kept that pace, they would probably make the playoffs.
I like it.
There we go. Eric Gordon's going to carry us to the playoffs until he gets hurt. All right. All right. Thanks, everybody, for listening to In the Know. And we'll be back Thursday
with good news.